Charles Seton Lindsay was only 17 years old when he ran away from home to join the Union Army. Years later, he wrote down his memories, and his Civil War memoir has been a family treasure for generations. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Charles Seton Lindsay's Civil War memoir, Some of Our Yesterdays, has now been published by his great-great-granddaughter, Sally Scott. I'll talk with her and with Cormat Brogue, who researched Lindsay's work, tracking down information about the people he served with and the battles he saw. This hour, one man's story of service in the Civil War. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. A young man, a recent immigrant, sees his new country being torn apart by war and feels that he must do his part to save the Union against the wishes of his family. That's where Charles Seton Lindsay's Civil War memoir, Some of Our Yesterdays, begins. The book has been a family treasure for generations, and it has now been published by Lindsay's great-great-granddaughter, Sally Scott. She's a community development consultant who's lived and worked in Iowa City, and she's with me now. Hello, Sally.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And tell me about this memoir. It's obviously been in your family for a very long time. Do you remember when you first learned about it?
I do. I remember seeing it on my grandparents' shelf and being very curious about it because nobody had really told me that much. We'd heard the basic story. We had a ancestor who fought in the Civil War, and it was in this kind of thin onion skin type paper. And so as a teenager, I decided to read it. And I found the Civil War portion of it fascinating. As a kid, it's almost impossible to imagine being 17 and doing what he did. There was a second part to the memoir covering his later career for the New York Life Insurance Company, which at that age I found not so fascinating.
a little duller to the teenage mind.
To the teenage mind. Much later, I found that part equally interesting, but it took me a while to get there.
Now, you have edited this manuscript, but the voice is so wrong. They're so, so strong. The writing is so compelling. Was that present in that original manuscript?
Oh, completely. And, you know, when we edited it, it was simply to clarify if there was a typo or a very obscure term that we felt people wouldn't understand. But I'd say 99% of this is his original voice. And he did not attend school after he enlisted at age 17. So it's an interesting question to me, that how did he develop this quite remarkable writing style, his voice?
Absolutely.
And without knowing the details, we do have books, old books in the family, which I think were part of his collection. So my working theory is that he got a very good education, you know, in middle and high school, and that he then educated himself by reading and probably a lot of fiction, because he really has a sense of how to tell a story.
So many of us have old letters or maybe old journals in our family, but very few of them read like great literature. And this must have been quite a treasure because of that.
It really was. What was interesting is, I read it as a teenager, loved that part about the Civil War, and then went back about 4 years ago. My grandparents' house, where this manuscript sat, is now a family house where we gather in the summer. It's on a lake in New Hampshire. And I reread it, and I thought, I read the whole thing this time. I thought, this is quite remarkable. I think I had just much more of an appreciation for it. And I encouraged my mother and my aunt and my sister and her husband to take a look. And that was the point at which we thought we really should do something with that. And I have to give my brother-in-law at the time credit, because he was the one who said, this should be published. I think we all thought, well, we should read it and we should enjoy it. But he had the vision that it should go beyond us.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation now, because when you decided to publish this and edit the manuscript, there was also a lot of research that had to go into this, because your great-great-grandfather, of course, was writing about true events, but we don't know what his perspective might have been, or how his observations, his experiences fit in with history. So you brought somebody in to help you put those pieces of the puzzle together. And Cormac Brogue is here. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa with a degree in history and political science, and he's going to become a lawyer. But Cormac, thank you for being here.
Hello. It's good to be here.
How did the two of you make this connection? How did you get involved in the project?
Well, I have to give a lot of the credit to one of my professors. I was writing my honors thesis on actually the politics of Iowa soldiers in the Civil War and how that was showed in their activities in the South. And my professor, Professor Priest, brought this project to me. He had this shared with him, and I was happy to come on board last summer and put in the research to help edit this manuscript.
Now, how much research needed to go into this? Because in the memoir, he refers to a number of different people, some of them maybe not by their full names, or some of them just by a description. How did you put the pieces of the puzzle together?
Well, there was some fun detective work to do with a piece like this. A lot of it was looking back at the regimental roster, which I was able to find. So I was able to kind of hunt down that for instance, a man who's just listed as S, being able to find out, a man listed as S died on this date that would correspond with the date that he left in
and his last name was Sullivan, which started with an S. So.
Yes, absolutely.
So he was, Charles Seton Lindsay was a part of the 36th Regiment, a volunteer regiment from New York. Cormac, can you give us a little bit of history of this regiment and how it worked?
So one very interesting thing about this regiment, the 36th New York, is that it's composed almost entirely of immigrants, which isn't in itself interesting, but because many regiments in the Civil War, especially from New York City, were composed of, well, mostly immigrants. What's particularly interesting about this regiment is it's composed of Irish and English immigrants, kind of put together through almost an accident of chance. And, well, as we know, in this era is not the time of great positive relationships between English and Irish people in the United States, or, of course, in the old world as well.
Well, and of course, a lot of the immigrants who enrolled or enlisted in the military, they needed the job. They needed the income. Charles Seton Lindsay, he needed the money, but that's not why he signed up. So, Sally, tell us about this young man, 17 years old, desperate to enlist. What was driving him?
Well, I want to go back to what Cormac was saying, that there's this, you know, tension between the English and Irish, because his father was English, but his mother was Irish. And I didn't know that until we did the research for this book. The family lore was that, oh, they came over from England. And the family lore also was that he was born in America. But we learned there's a ship manifest from the boat that brought the whole family over, and he was listed on that as a passenger. So he was an immigrant himself, which we didn't know that. So the little that we know about his father is that he was in a business, and that business was failing, and that the problems with the business were connected to the war. So one can imagine that maybe it was a trading business, and of course, with the war, a lot of trade got disrupted. And so with the business failing, the father's business failing, Charles Seton Lindsay thought, you know, I've got to do something. But I really think his prime motivation was the sense that the Union has to stand. This was his country. He'd come over at age 4 or 5, and he strongly believed in the importance of the Union. What was interesting is that he also later, not discussed in the book at all, he also later married a woman from Baltimore from a family with affinity with the South. So as you go through the book, his patriotism comes through, and the strength of his convictions, but also his understanding that the people he was fighting against were, you know, equally human and
equally American.
Equally American, and he has no rancor. He has no bitterness. I mean, it's many years later. He's writing this almost 50 years later. But I think, you know, in our current political situation, many political situations, you see this extreme, almost demonizing of the enemy. And what he projects is almost the opposite of that. I think it's a deep compassion and deep understanding.
His conviction that he needed to enlist is interesting to me because he even, it's against the wishes of his family. Mm-hmm. They don't want him to enlist. Plus, he's 17 years old, so he's not supposed to be able to enlist anyway. And he writes about this process that he has to go through, going from one enlistment center to another, trying to get somebody to sign him up.
Yeah, he had tremendous determination. And I think that comes through, you know, in that opening passage, but throughout that when he set his mind on something, he was not going to be stopped. Because when he finally did get accepted, they said, okay, you can be, you know, a drummer boy. You know, you can tap along and keep the time. And he, you know, pulls himself up to his full height, which I think was about 5'4".
Right, not very tall.
And says, no, I want to fight. And he must have impressed the people that, you know, he was trying to impress because they said, okay. And he turned out to be, I think, quite an able soldier, despite being on the smaller side.
Absolutely. And we'll find out more about his service in a few minutes. But this group of mostly immigrants, Irish and English immigrants that did volunteer, that enlisted, I was also struck by, you know, the need that drove most of them there. And thinking about these young men, or maybe not young men, as soldiers. This was kind of a motley crew. These guys were hungry. They were poor. They'd had no training. I mean, it's really interesting to think of them trying to coalesce as a unit, Cormac.
Yeah, and it is. And it's an interesting thing that comes out of the early American Civil War is almost no one has actual military experience. Both armies at the beginning of the war are, well, totally green, as Lincoln, I believe, once said. And you have these groups of volunteers that are just coming together, people who have never fought an enemy before. One interesting thing about this regiment is it does have some people with military experience. It kind of stands out because some of these English and Irish immigrants had previously served in the British Army during the Crimean War and during colonial conflicts. And so it has kind of an interesting a mix, even particularly to this regiment, with the vast majority who have never seen a battle before, and a few of the handful who have.
The descriptions that he shared of the kinds of training that he went through, I could feel my anxiety rising, thinking that's what you've done and you're going to go into battle where your lives are at risk. It doesn't seem very extensive.
No, it really doesn't. And a lot of this is just a lot of understanding how to march in a line and how to load and fire your weapon were such important characteristics that they're not getting the type of training we expect of a military today.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about a Civil War memoir. It's called Some of Our Yesterdays, written by Charles Seton Lindsay. With me today is Charles Seton Lindsay's great-great-granddaughter, Sally Scott, who decided to publish this work and bring it to the rest of us instead of just keep it as a family treasure. Also with me, Cormac Brogue. He's a graduate in history and political science from the University of Iowa and helped research this book. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about a Civil War memoir. It's called Some of Our Yesterdays, and it was written by a man named Charles Seton Lindsay. He ran away from home at the age of 17 to enlist in the Union Army on the basis of conviction. It's something he believed he needed to do. He was also an immigrant, so it was something he felt he needed to do to preserve the Union of his new country. This memoir, after being a family treasure for generations, has now been published, and Charles Seton Lindsay's great-great-granddaughter, Sally Scott, is here with us. She's a community development consultant who's lived and worked in Iowa City. She published this work. And also with us, Cormac Brogue. He is a graduate in history and political science from the University of Iowa, and he researched this memoir to create footnotes, to put this in context with the history that, of course, now we know so much about with the Civil War. And just before the break, we were talking about the sort of cursory kind of training that this regiment went through. And he has really some wonderful observations in the memoir about the training. And I love that he referred to it as, it's light work. So it really didn't sound particularly rigorous. When you read that, Sally, what goes through your mind?
Just that it's hard to imagine, you know, being ready to fight after going through this. And, you know, we were talking before about the mix of English and Irish immigrants with native-born Americans, but there was also this tremendous difference in life experience. I mean, he's a young man coming from a, you know, a somewhat sheltered middle-class background. You know, his parents, I don't think the business was doing well, but I think they were able to provide him with certain comforts. And the men he's encountering are, you know, that he talks about the drinking and about the women, you know, who are coming by their training and the smoking. And these are very foreign things to him. Yet, to his credit, he realizes that these people are of tremendous value. He forms very strong bonds with people I think he initially feels very different from. And I think that's a kind of defining quality of his character, his kind of openness, his interest in connecting. So, and I think when you get into battle, and Cormac may know more about this than I do from his studies, but when you get into battle, it's those bonds which really determine whether you're going to, you know, keep fighting or retreating or disband. You know, those are what hold a group of soldiers together.
When he volunteered in New York, he stayed in New York for a while. Some early training was done and then moved on south. And so they get to Maryland and to the Washington, D.C. area as all of these troops from different regiments are coming together. And I was, you know, struck both by the mass of soldiers coming together, but then also how small these battalions were that were going to be going into battle. But there's this really remarkable scene that gives us some incredible insight into the politics of this moment in time. This is an opportunity where his regiment is going to be inspected by the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. Sally, could you read us a little bit from that section of the book?
I will. Word was now passed that General McClellan and the President would review us. No one cared much about the latter, but all put on their best faces for Little Mac, who presently, sitting his horse splendidly and followed by a large staff of well-groomed officers, approached us at a slow trot. By his side was what, to me, was the most extraordinary sight of the kind I had ever seen, a long, lank man wearing a high black hat, a long black frock coat, the lower button fastened so that it ballooned out in front of his chest, and there a large expanse of tossed white shirt and a narrow black tie with flying ends, black trousers wrinkling halfway up to the knee, exposed shoes, and white socks as he bumped up and down on his horse, holding the reins with both hands and looking a picture of utter discomfort. It took me some time to realize that what I saw was the President of the United States, and my only feeling after my first amazement was one of amusement, tinged with a bit of mortification at the uncouthness of it all. Cheers went up as the party rode down the ranks, but they were all for the general. Little did I, or practically anyone that day, realize that this man alongside General McClellan, so little known, so generally misunderstood, so often ridiculed, so frequently despised, was one of the very greatest men God ever blessed the world with. I have often since thought of the agonized anxiety which for those long years must have possessed his great, strong, gentle soul as he tried to pierce the fog of distress and uncertainty which surrounded us, a fog which at times shut down so close that only men who meant to win or die could ever have forced their way out of it. Of such type of men there were, thank God, not a few from the president down to the drummer boys. Nor were the sweethearts, wives, and mothers behind in their devotion. Such men and women do not make much noise. They save their breath for working.
That's just a moment, a passage from some of our yesterday's A Civil War memoir written by Charles Seton Lindsay. And He writes before going into that description that he remembers this with shame, that he wasn't excited about seeing the President of the United States, and he was derisive when he saw the President of the United States, which really gives us some insight into the politics of the time, because Abraham Lincoln was not popular back home, at least where Charles came from.
Right. In the New York area, he was not popular, and among the soldiers— my understanding is that McClellan was revered, and that comes through. And, you know, this was a thought that this was who was going to lead them to victory. And sadly, that turned out not to be the case, and that it was Lincoln who, through great trials and multiple generals, was the one who led the country to victory. But this is very early in the war, and I think we have to remember that there was the sense that the North was going to sweep down and overcome the South quite easily, and as we know,
the idea that it was going to be over very quickly. And this would have been in 1861.
Yes.
Right. I am struck, though, although he wasn't, it claimed to not be impressed by the president, the detail in that description, it must have made a great impression on his mind, because as you mentioned, he wrote this many years later, maybe 50 years later.
And I've been puzzled by that, because the details throughout are phenomenal. I mean, it's very precise, and I think he understands that to tell a story well, you have to include these details. So did he keep notes at the time? We don't know. We don't have any handwritten notes of his, which would be wonderful if we did. All we have is this one typed manuscript of the final product. It's possible he just had a phenomenal memory, but my guess is that he was keeping some kind of notes at the time.
Well, and Cormac, when we think about looking into Civil War history and the politics of the time, I mean, it's instructive to know that these men who were going off to war, who so many of them would never come home again, it sounds like they weren't entirely behind the President of the United States. They weren't necessarily all filled with conviction.
Well, I think that's true. There's we sometimes forget when we look back at history, there's always been a partisan divide. And there certainly was one in the North during the Civil War. And in New York City in particular, Lincoln was, as we talked about, very unpopular in 1863. Touch on this a bit in Lindsay doesn't really go deep into this in the book, but there's a giant draft riot in New York City against the policies of the Lincoln administration. In 1864, when General McClellan will run for president against Abraham Lincoln, he'll win the vote in New York City by a substantial margin. So we often forget when we look back at history how strong partisanship can be across American history. And it's very strong in the North during the Civil War.
As the regiment begins to move south into Virginia and gets closer to the possibility of battle, Lindsay is climbing through the ranks. He is getting promotions, which also struck me as surprising, considering how young he was, considering how little experience he had. And I mean, Cormac, can you shed a little bit of light on that? Again, we talked about how so few of these men had military experience, so the leaders had to come from within the ranks, even if they'd only been in a few weeks or a couple of months.
Yeah, there's a it's a meritocratic element to these Civil War regiments, because since there aren't people with a lot of training, it means that, yes, these volunteers, those that look like they have promise, are being promoted rather rapidly. Now, by the end of the war, by the end of his time in the conflict, he's essentially commanding a company of men. Now, he is quite young for that. Many of them would be older than himself. But young men rapidly rising through the ranks during the war is something that is seen really across these volunteer Civil War regiments. Just the lack of leadership combined with, the heavy casualties means that young men who show some qualities that that a commander would look for are often rapidly promoted, and they find themselves going from maybe a farm boy or someone helping off with their father's business to commanding 60, 70, sometimes even hundreds of men.
I was struck as he reminisced, but recollected his hopes for promotion, that one of the reasons he wanted to be promoted was so he wouldn't have to carry his 70-pound pack.
That was probably half his weight.
Right, yeah. Because he was a small man, so he was hoping to only have to take a saber with him.
I think also he wanted to send the money home. And that was part of his motivation as well. He knew that they were struggling back at home. And I do love in the passage I just read that he's talking about there are those who, from the president on down, who really were strong in the cause and strong in their work ethic. And he includes the sweethearts, wives, and mothers. I think his own mother, who only makes a brief appearance here, but a very important one, was a powerful force in his life.
We have a phone call from someone else with Civil War history in their family, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Lynn is on the line in Riverside. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. This is a very interesting input on McClellan. For a long time, I've been learning history of my great-grandfather, Samuel Shadman, that was an attaché to McClellan during the war. And McClellan got a bad rap, and his soldiers loved him because they didn't push them into battle to get murdered because the supplies and everything else, it was crazy what they were being told to do, and he was strong enough to resist. And his soldiers survived, and he got a bad rap. And in our family, McClellan is revered. Matter of fact, there's a lot of Uncle Clells and stuff like that in our family. And it was very interesting that someone else showed the input of how people really didn't go along with Lincoln. And some of these people like Grant and the guy that went down and burned Atlanta and all these things were cut through murderers. And then later they murdered buffalo and Indians. So I just thought that was a good input.
Well, and Lynn, did your great-grandfather, did he leave writings behind? Do you have a record of his service?
No, but there's a picture of him in, you know, the Burns Civil War book.
Yes.
That went along with it. On page 92, there's a picture of him standing by him. He was a tall redhead. And also they had that picture of him, I think that same picture in Pennsylvania or something where he was from, over the mantle. My mom remembered it, but it somehow it disappeared. But, yeah, isn't it crazy that he got such a bad rap and he
well,
was one of the best.
Well, it was a very complicated time. Lynn, thank you so much for your call. Obviously, I guess some of those feelings still run deep for people. I want to talk about an encounter that Charles Seton Lindsay had after he received promotion and was carrying a saber. They were traveling through an area and a young man approaches him, a freedom seeker, a man who was trying to escape slavery. And maybe I should say a boy, because he was probably only 15 years old, although not much younger than Lindsay himself. Tell me about him, Sally.
Lewis Cass Pipsico had run off from slavery, as you said. He was seeking freedom. And what I find fascinating is he picked my great-great-grandfather. He said, I want to work for you. And Charles Seton Lindsay was reluctant. He didn't know what the regulations were. Was he allowed to do this? And he tried to...
And he didn't have any money. He said, I can't pay you.
Right, right. So he tried to push him off and said, you know, I can't do this. But Pipsico, kind of like Lindsay in many ways, very determined young man, very eager to be a part of this regiment and stuck around and really gained, I think, the deep affection and friendship of Lindsay over time. And a lot of the stories about him are really show his intelligence, his ability to get through very, very tough situations. And what Cormac taught me was that often when freed slaves appear in these narratives, they're very one-dimensional characters. You don't really learn that much about them. But here, he's a fully fleshed out character, and Cormack also found that after the war, PepsiCo ended up in Newark, New Jersey, which was where my great-great-grandfather was from, working as, I think, initially a chimney sweep and a roofer. So that friendship may have continued after the war, and I would love to be able to find out if that was the case.
Absolutely. Well, and I can imagine that many freedom seekers joined these regiments as they were traveling through the South as just an opportunity, sort of a grab at freedom, a possibility. And at this time, in 1861, 1862, there was controversy over what should be done with these freedom seekers. But in many cases, they were returned to their quote-unquote owners, right, Cormack?
Yeah, this is true. In the early part of the conflict, Union officers really had no idea what they were supposed to do with people who had self-emancipated, who'd freed themselves from slavery by going across the lines. And so you do have these two eventually, Congress begins to pass laws, but those don't provide that much guidance. Originally, they just allow enslaved people who were forced to work for the Confederate military to be free. Over time, this issue doesn't really become settled until the Emancipation Proclamation, which of course makes these people free when they self-emancipate by fleeing to Union lines.
Well, and at this time in the war, although slavery was a huge issue in the war, the war wasn't necessarily going to settle that issue.
No. When this war began, there's a lot of confusion among the Union Army and Union politicians as to whether once this war ends, it'll return to the Constitution as a lot of people phrase it, or it'll be a new society in which the slave system is destroyed. And that eventually really isn't settled until the 13th Amendment at the end of the conflict.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the Civil War experiences of Charles Seton Lindsay. He wrote a memoir of his service in the Civil War. It was a family treasure for many generations, and now Sally Scott, his great-great-granddaughter, has published this book, so many people can read it and share in this work. Cormack Brogue is also with me. He researched the footnotes for the book. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're looking back at the Civil War service of Charles Seton Lindsay. He wrote a remarkable memoir remembering his time in service. He was 17 years old when he enlisted against the wishes of his family, and he wrote this memoir. Many years later, it was kept in the family, and now it's been published. It's called Some of Our Yesterdays, and his great-great-granddaughter, Sally Scott, is the one who published it and brought it to the rest of us. Also with us, Cormack Brogue. He graduated from the University of Iowa in history and political science and worked on researching this book so he could put all of these stories into perspective with the history that we know now. And we've talked about how young Lindsay was, and as he was getting promoted and they're traveling through this area, and they still hadn't really seen battle, but they come across the aftermath of a battle. So this is really the first time that he sees the true horror of war. And Cormack, I would love for you to read to us a little bit from that passage.
In one place, as I came along, I saw at some distance to the side, two men standing facing each other against the trunk of a tree. Going there, I found they were a northerner and a southerner. The former had pinned his enemy to the tree with his bayonet, while the southerner, in his last agony, had evidently fired his pistol straight into the northern man's face and practically blown it to pieces. There they stood, the one spiked to the tree with his head hanging forward on his enemy's shoulder, his limp arms by his side, the other supported by his gun, which was still gripped in his stiff hands, his body arched back as from the force of the shot, what was left of his face staring up into the heavens. All that held him up was the hold of his gun. So dreadful a sight may I never see again. Men of the same country, the same race, the same religion, and both unquestionably patriots. God assail their souls. They both thought they were right and died for their belief. Sick at heart, I pointed them out to the burying squad and hastened on with the regiment, for we were to pass beyond the city and this time to take our places in the vanguard.
His first real battle that he was a part of was the Battle of Fair Oaks, or Seven Pines, May 31st, 1862. Tell me about this battle.
So this battle takes place during a campaign that's called the Peninsula Campaign. General McClellan decided to move his then quite large Army of the Potomac. He decided instead of marching directly south, he'd actually move them south by sea and then attack Richmond from Virginia's peninsula. This is the first major battle in that campaign. There had been other engagements, one of which Seton Lindsay had described. But this in many ways is a very chaotic affair. And it's seeing both armies essentially just run into each other at this place, at this crossing called Fair Oaks or Seven Pines. And it's a battle that, is quite a bloody conflict.
How bloody? How many? Do you remember approximately how many casualties there were? It's all right if you don't have that number at your fingertips. I was struck in some of your footnotes, and I can't come up with the number myself right now, but how many thousands of soldiers died in these battles? There was so much loss. And I know that during the Civil War, there was also a great deal of loss to dysentery and hardship as well. But these battles were so brutal and bloody.
They certainly were. And what's interesting about this campaign, the Peninsula Campaign, in Virginia in the spring and early summer of 1862, is that it's a you see first this battle at Fair Oaks and then the 7 days battles outside of Richmond. And neither side really gains anything from this campaign. McClellan decides to retreat, even though he has superior numbers and wins most of those battles. And so you see these losses in many ways for nothing. And that even was even more particularly galling across both sides, is that you have these heavy casualties in this campaign, and really neither side gains anything from these heavy losses.
I was struck in remembering this battle. Lindsay kills a man, and he writes about how that has haunted his conscience forever.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you react to that? I mean, he was a soldier. He was in battle.
Well, he seems to have this remarkable ability to see war from the inside out and the outside in. So he understands that when you're in war, that's what you do. And you get caught up in that, and it's exciting, and there's even a rush to that moment. But then as he reflects upon it, there's no glamorization. There's no joy that he takes in this killing. If anything, I think he is very sorry that it had to happen. And I think with the passage that we just read is a tableau that really illustrates how awful the war really is. And there's no, in part because of the time that he fought, the first 2 years of the war, there's no great sense of, you know, glory and marching to victory. It's just the slog and the violence and the camaraderie that he does manage to achieve, you know, with his fellow soldiers.
Now, he does get injured in this battle, very seriously injured, nearly died, and was rescued by some of his compatriots who managed to get him to safety. And the first thing that he really remembers after being struck, he doesn't even really seem to know where he was struck, was the surgeon saying that we have to take off your leg. And I was again struck by his determination at that point. Tell us what happened, Sally.
Really remarkable because, you know, it's taken some time and some great effort of his fellow soldiers to get him away from the battlefield to this surgeon. And, you know, when the surgeon says, I'm taking that leg off, he completely refuses. He knows of another surgeon who's a friend of his, and he says, take me to that other surgeon. So these poor guys who've carried him to the first surgeon.
Right, and now
surgeon,
carry him at least another mile.
Another
or
mile,
farther.
And you imagine the kind of pain he was in, and probably the fatigue and pain they were in, but they do it for him, and it goes back to those ties we were talking about, how intense those were, that they were willing to do this for him.
And I get the impression that as the surgeon let him leave, they probably thought, he's going to die on the stretcher.
Right.
That's his call.
But he finds a surgeon that he knows who agrees to try to save the leg, and then offers him anesthetic. And, of course, any of us would have taken it, even if it was a primitive anesthetic at the time, and he says no. So once again, it's like, how can, you know, maybe he was 18 at the time. How could he have endured that? This operation to dig these bullets out of his badly injured leg with no anesthetic, just some, I think, a piece of wood to bite on.
And as he's recovering in the Army hospital, and actually it seems to have a better experience than many in these Army hospitals, because having read descriptions, he was very fortunate in his recovery, but he's not getting better. And so his mother comes and she takes him home, which probably saved his life.
I'm almost certain. He basically had started to get better, and then he said, oh, I did too much. You know, he's trying to move himself around. Very, very hard to be confined. And he has a kind of a relapse. The wound gets reopened. And, his mother comes down, and I would love to know more how she did it. She just talks to people and says, I'm taking him with me. And he says, no, you can't do that. She said, it's all arranged.
Right, but I don't think it was.
Well, yeah, we learn afterwards that he's briefly accused of desertion, but then that does get cleared up. But she had to get him on this train, and he describes so beautifully how he resented people pitying him. You know, here he was probably at 90-something pounds at that point. He was terribly emaciated, terribly sick. But she got him home, got him into his bed, and nursed him back to health. Finally, he did recover his health, and then the first thing is he's going back.
Well, and he also has learned of another promotion to second lieutenant. Then he decides to go back, and he becomes a first lieutenant. He gets a very nice position where he's basically a kind of a secretary or an attaché, but says, no, I need to go back to my unit, although he could barely walk. I mean, he was still using a cane.
Yeah, and throughout his life, he had difficulty with that leg. But, yeah, he didn't want the cushy position. He didn't want to be just attending to the generals. He wanted to be back with his men.
I'm worried that we're going to run out of time here, but I would love for you to read a little bit from an experience that he had that really demonstrates the fact that these were Americans on both sides of the war, and they knew it. The soldiers at the front who were fighting each other knew that they were fighting their brothers.
We could see the enemy on the opposite side of the river, here not more than 100 yards wide. One evening, as I was inspecting, one of them struck up Maryland, My Maryland, and his companions joined in the air, simple and pretty. The effect was beautiful as the sound was borne on the evening breeze, all the more so because it was so unexpected. Strange how a little thing like that softens one's heart and takes it home into scenes far away. I stopped and listened. It was too dark to see the singers, and fires were not allowed, but their hearts were in their voices, and like myself, I felt their thoughts, too, were with their loved ones at home. Hardly had the song ceased when my nearest post struck up, of all things in the world, John Brown's Body Lies a-Moldering in the Grave, also a catchy, simple air. I saw no reason why I should stop them and waited till they had finished, but when, their hearts opened by this interchange of song, the opposing posts began to shout salutations across the water to each other, of a nature perfectly friendly, but perhaps a bit uncouth, I thought it best to stop it, particularly as a couple of inquiries were being made as to the whereabouts of friends serving on the opposite side. While our men doubtless knew nothing of what our future movements might be or the present disposition of our troops, it was just as well to avoid any possible accident.
But he does find them trading with the other troops. The South, they have tobacco. The North, they have coffee. And the troops start trading with each other.
Yeah, he's worried. He sees this little basket,
Raffles, yeah.
Little basket attached to a string going back and forth. And I think at this point it's the Rappahannock River in Virginia. And he's worried this is purloined dispatches. But he goes down and discovers it's just a crumbling leaf of tobacco being exchanged from south to north, and the Southerners really want the coffee.
The second main battle that he really is involved in is the Second Battle of Fredericksburg. It's May 3rd, 1863. Cormac, we don't have time to read from it, but describe this battle.
It's a battle that takes place on a previous battleground. There's a very bloody battle in December of 1862 in which Union soldiers famously charged up heights called Marie's Heights and were decimated by the Confederate defenders of those hills. Now, in the spring of 1863, the Union soldiers again are again attacking Marye's Heights. Now most of the Confederate Army has moved away. The Battle of Chancellorsville is going to be fought just a short distance away in another part of Virginia. But Seton Lindsay is one of these people attacking the Heights the second time. And it is a rather fierce engagement as he's in it. And he's describing how he's seeing all these things happening around him, troops moving back and forth, artillery batteries being decimated by his side's fire. And it's really how he talks about how he's going to remember war from that point on. The confusion and the men cheering for the deaths of other men is something that really seems to stay with him.
When they volunteered for 2 years. And the men who survived, most of them did muster out at that 2-year mark, right?
So it depends that in the grand scheme of thing, that depends on the regiment themselves. But it seems most of these 36 New York men had enough of the war. They'd done their service to their country and they were ready to go home. And that's what Seton Lindsay does at the end of the conflict. And when he goes home, he finds that, well, all the jobs have been taken up by the men who stayed behind. He has to start from the bottom again.
As he leaves the military, he goes on to have a successful future. As you mentioned, that memoir doesn't just end with the Civil War. It goes on to talk about his career in insurance, which may be less important to history. But what do you think it meant to him, this service?
I think he learned a tremendous amount about himself, his capacities. As we've said, he rose quickly. He was commanding men much older than himself, showed tremendous bravery. And I think the determination that he showed in enlisting, he took that throughout his career, which involved going to places all over the world where he didn't necessarily know the culture and the language and working in these places and being successful at it. But I think when he's writing, it's World War I. And young men are killing each other of the same race, maybe of the same religion. And he's perhaps upset that this is happening again in his lifetime. It must have been devastating, though America, I don't think, had entered the war by the time he was writing, just to see this terrible thing happening again. He has no love of war, though he understands that, you know, perhaps it's going to happen, has to happen. He shows no love for it.
How long did he live?
He lived until 1924, so he was, I think, in his 80s by the time that he died, and he was back in New York at the time after working all over the world, and his son, he had two sons. His older son also settled in New York, and then his second son went and settled in California, so the travel bug was still with the family.
You chose to publish this book. It's a small run. It's available at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. It's not all over the place. But what do you hope people take away from reading about your great-great-grandfather?
Well, I think just appreciation for him and his character. I think, you know, there are a lot of ways in which his country at the time and our country now were extremely divided. But to be able to reflect upon that and, you know, understand the essential humanity of the people on the other side of the political equation or the other side of the battlefield, I think takes a real stretch of the imagination to not assume that these are somehow lesser beings. And I just would hope that people and also the fact that he, you know, he found it so rewarding to connect with people very different than himself, including Lewis Cass Pipsico, who, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about, but who is really a critical character in the book. So I think we have a lot to learn from Charles Seton Lindsay and kind of remembering what, you know, fundamentally our country's about is that openness to people of really different backgrounds.
Sally Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Charity.
Thank you for sharing your great-great-grandfather's story with us. And Cormac Broke, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for connecting all of the pieces of this puzzle so that we can put it in perspective with what we know of the history of the Civil War now. The memoir is called Some of Our Yesterdays, a Civil War memoir. Charles Seton Lindsay is the writer, and his great-great-granddaughter Sally Scott has published it. Again, it's available at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.